It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today we talk to a man who brings the cosmos right down into our coffee cups. He is physicist Sidney Perkowitz, a man fascinated by foam. So today he explains how foam is the link between your espresso, the cup you drink it from, and the stars that you gaze at night. Jane and Michael Stern are unraveling the mysteries of Cincinnati five-way chili. Matthew Goodman brings us the origins of the famous Sabbath bread, challah. And we go to a new kind of rave, a wine rave. I've got a restaurant pick in San Diego. And all of this comes with your calls, coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide for nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. I was roaming the supermarket last night, and I started thinking about how many bottled dressings there are and how a lot of them don't deliver an awful lot of good taste. So I thought maybe a single, simple, homemade dressing concept might be helpful. The idea is you improvise one basic dressing that you can mix up just by shaking the ingredients together in a jar. And it keeps in the refrigerator for a week or more. Now, this dressing will be excellent on its own, but each time you use it, you could add different ingredients and make an entirely different recipe, from Italian to ranch to blue cheese. For great tasting homemade dressings, you do have to do a little hunting and gathering. But once it's done, it's over. So get some good-tasting olive oil and vinegars with great flavor. In the vinegar realm, you could choose from wine or cider vinegars, balsamic, Spanish sherry vinegar, or Japanese rice vinegar. I like rice vinegar because it's gentle and I need less oil with it. Also, it's great mixed with balsamic vinegar in a dressing. In the flavoring department, think organic fresh herbs, but if you can't get your hands on them, dried herbs will do just fine. Of course, there's garlic and onion. They're essential. And then there's cheeses, spices, chilies, sun-dried tomatoes, olives, capers. You can have a field day with all the possibilities. But let's start at the beginning. Here's the basic dressing. Now, you have to make this by taste, not by measurements. Take a screw-top jar, a pint one should work fine, fill it a quarter full with good-tasting vinegar. Now add the same amount of olive oil. Shake it up and taste it. See if it needs more oil or more vinegar. Then you could add salt and pepper. Okay, let's say you want to dress a salad. This simple oil and vinegar dressing with the salt and pepper is the true classic Italian or French dressing. The French call it vinaigrette, and you can use it just as it is. But if you love a particular herb, sprinkle it over the salad as you toss it with the dressing. Turn the basic dressing into a Dijon dressing by putting some of it in a bowl, stir in some Dijon mustard, some tarragon, and some minced garlic or shallot. Keep tasting and keep mixing, and that way you'll know when you hit it the way you want it. How about a honey mustard dressing? Take that Dijon dressing, stir in more mustard, and some honey or brown sugar to taste. Some people also add a little bit of mayonnaise to that. Blue cheese dressing. There is nothing better, as far as I'm concerned. What you do here is you take the basic dressing, you add a little blue cheese, a hint of garlic, and that's it. If you like the creamy style, do what I just said, but then stir in a bit of mayo and sour cream. Now, ranch dressing is a great favorite. You can mix it right in the salad bowl. Just stir together equal parts of your basic dressing, some buttermilk, and mayo. Then add minced fresh scallions, some fresh basil, and parsley. Garlic is great in ranch dressing, but add it gradually to keep it from overpowering everything else. Now, here's something to think about. Once you've got your dressings, you should know that each one of them makes a dynamite marinade. For instance, try marinating shrimp in that ranch dressing. and then grill them. How about beef in honey mustard? Do it with kebabs. Keep them rare, but grill them until they're crusty. The Dijon dressing is going to be wonderful with something like chicken breasts. There, just put them in the dressing overnight, and then put them in a sauté pan or roast them in the oven. And then that basic oil and vinegar dressing, use that to marinate vegetables that you're going to roast or you're going to grill. So try making your own salad dressings this week and try turning them into marinades. And join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by the kitchenware area at Target, where you'll find a complete assortment of fondue sets, including the Farberware Commercial Fondue, featuring an 1810 stainless steel fondue pot, jewel-toned color-coded forks, and black ceramic ramekins. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Today, we take a look at a substance you've probably not thought much about. It's foam. Our guest is Sidney Perkowitz, professor of physics at Emory University. His book is called Universal Foam, From Cappuccino to the Cosmos. Matthew Goodman is back. Matthew brings us reports on Jewish food traditions. Well, today it's the origins of the famous Sabbath bread, challah. And there's a bonus, Matthew's favorite recipe for challah French toast. We're going to a wine rave with the Wine Brats. Now, this is the crew of people who are some of the children of American winemakers. They realized that their peers felt that wine was stuffy, complicated, and generally not their thing. The Brats believe wine should be accessible, that quality is the issue, not quantity, and they've created the wine rave. I've got a restaurant find in San Diego. Then, as always, we open the lines for your calls in the second half of the show. The number is 800-537-5252. Well, Jane and Michael Stern are here to get things rolling. They write the road food column in Gourmet Magazine. So, Jane, Michael, where have you been wandering?
Well, that's a good question. We've been in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I still can't figure out whether we're in the Midwest or the South when we're in Cincinnati. But as long as we stick with the most famous indigenous cuisine of Cincinnati, which is five-way chili, it doesn't matter geographically where we are because it could only be Cincinnati.
You have to explain five-way chili, I think.
We do indeed, because if you think of chili as something from Texas, chili con carne, in other words, meat and chili peppers, you have completely the wrong idea. Cincinnati five-way chili is an architecturally layered dish of spaghetti noodles topped with spiced meat with a kind of Greek-accented spice mixture, kidney beans, raw onions, cheese, and oyster crackers on the side.
It's called a little Baroque
around the edges.
A little Rococo.
Yes.
It's called a hay wagon because that implies it's just overloaded, brimming dish covered with cheese that looks like, you know, a big hay wagon. When Michael and I wrote Chili Nation, the reviews from Texas single out Cincinnati as the greatest abomination.
A crime
against chili-eating humanity. I mean, you could start a civil war between what Texans think of as a bowl of red, you know, their mm-hmm. famous chili, and Cincinnati chili. I personally adore Cincinnati chili, if only for the chili itself, which John Johnson, who runs our favorite chili parlor in Cincinnati called Camp Washington, back in 1977 gave us his secret chili recipe, and this recipe must have 37 ingredients in it. I mean, everything from mace to cardamom to bitter chocolate. I mean, it is the most kaleidoscopic recipe for something as simple as just something you ladle on spaghetti and dump a lot of American cheese on top of.
But, you know, that I think is the thing that's so fascinating about chili, that everybody, it's like pasta, everybody adopted it and then sort of added what they felt made sense to it. So,
well, what's so interesting about Cincinnati is that there's a real sort of chili culture there. There are at least 100 restaurants in town that specialize in this particular kind of chili, which, by the way, you can get three-way or four-way if you want to drop the onions or the beans. But it actually goes back to the 1920s, and it was invented or created by a bunch of Greek immigrants who came to Cincinnati by way of Coney Island, where they learned to make this meaty chili sauce as a topping for hot dogs. And to this day, virtually every chili parlor in Cincinnati serves not only chili, but also what they call Coney Islands, which are hot dogs topped with the same chili meat.
Now, where do you guys like to eat? Is it this John guy's?
Yeah, Camp Washington, which is run by a Greek man whose name is very un-Greek. It's John Johnson. He really is the pride of independent chili eating in Cincinnati. As Michael said, there are a million chain restaurants like Skyline and what's the other big one?
Gold Star and Skyline are the big ones.
Right, or Steak and Shake, all of which, you know, serve Cincinnati five-way chili. It's harder to find the one-man operation. And John Johnson and his Camp Washington chili, I think pretty much not just my point of view or Michael's, but in general, is regarded in Cincinnati as the number one chili.
One of the things that's great about Camp Washington is its hours of operation. It is open all the time, except from midnight to 4 a.m. on Sunday morning.
We have to cook the chili sometime.
That's right.
So you mean you can go there for breakfast?
Well, there are many people who believe that the best time to eat Cincinnati chili is about 3 in the morning, a kind of kill or cure gastronomy.
And that's after the beer that you might be drinking in Cincinnati.
Right.
Guys, okay,
it.
Camp Washington, five-way
right.
chili.
At Tell John Johnson, Jane and Michael sent you.
You got it. Thanks, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
That's guitarist Lonnie Mack with Camp Washington Chili. The place has a lot of fans. Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Eat Your Way Across the USA and Chili Nation. They join us every week here on the Splendid Table, and every week you can get their food finds on our website at splendidtable.org. Matthew Goodman writes about Jewish culinary traditions for The Forward. He always seems to take us down surprising roads. Montreal for bagels, Bukharin restaurants, places you wouldn't think to look for authentic Jewish foods. Hey, Matthew, welcome.
Thanks, Lynn.
Matthew, I want to talk about challah, the bread.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing I want to know is how do you pronounce it?
Yes, well, that's the big problem. I mean, you know, ideally you're pronouncing it with that ch sound, challah.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that guttural sound that makes you sound like you're clearing your throat. But, you know, in my neighborhood growing up, people actually called it holly. You know, do you want a piece of holly? So I think it's pretty loose. The main thing is you just get your meaning across.
All right, now tell me, what is it really?
The word challah actually comes from the Bible, where it meant Sabbath bread. But, of course, the bread that they were making then was very different than the challah that we think of today. It was round and flat, unleavened, more like pita bread. The challah of today is a much sweeter, richer, almost cake-like sort of bread that's enriched with eggs and sugar and oil. It has a shiny crust made so with an egg wash. Often it has poppy seeds and sesame seeds sprinkled on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's often braided. And that bread seems to have come from Germany in around the 15th century, where German Jews adopted a new form of Sabbath bread, which they modeled on a braided bread that was very popular among the Germans. And they called this bread Birschis. Now, it's not exactly clear where that name came from. It's actually a subject of some contention among food historians.
Mm-hmm.
Some people say that the braids were meant to represent interlocked arms, and so the origin is the old German word Brigitte, meaning arms.
Uh-huh.
Other people say that it has to do with the German fertility goddess Berchta, or Berchta, for whom German women often baked braided loaves of bread. The braids were supposed to represent a woman's braided hair. Other people say that the origin is in the Hebrew word bruchot, or in Yiddish bruches, meaning blessings, which was the word that was often engraved on the knives that were used to cut the Sabbath bread. Nobody really knows for sure. But what we do know is that in other areas of that region, people simply called this bread challah, using the biblical word for Sabbath bread. And as this bread began to move eastward with the Jewish migrations of the late Middle Ages into Poland and Lithuania, that's what it came to be known as. And what's also interesting is that not only did the name change, but also the taste of the bread began to change. Because, you know, in Germany, this bread had that pronounced sourdough flavor, which is so common of the breads of Central Europe.
Uh-huh.
But once it got to Poland, it became much sweeter. And this is true about many Jewish foods in Poland. They're much sweeter. And this has to do with the fact that sugar beets were very plentiful in this region, and the local sugar processing plants were often owned by Jews, and so sugar was relatively cheap and accessible. And also because there were a great number of Hasidim in that area, the Hasidim were the ultra-Orthodox Jews, who associate sugar with the joy and sweetness of religious celebration. And so they like their food sweet, and so the bread became sweet, and that's the bread that we know as challah today.
Now, how is challah used traditionally in a Jewish home?
Traditionally, it's served on festive occasions. It's a very festive-looking bread, and you serve it for Sabbath dinners, for holiday celebrations, and so forth. But you know something? Most people associate it with that, Lynn. I associate challah with something else. I associate it with breakfast.
Breakfast?
And specifically challah French toast. And the reason is because of a restaurant that called Peter Pan in the town called Great Neck, Long Island, where I grew up, which had the most outstanding challah French toast. It was these large wedges of challah that were deep fried. Now, that may not sound great, but this was outstanding French toast. And unfortunately, the restaurant closed shortly afterward, and I became haunted by the memory of this French toast. You know, Proust had his Madeleine, I have challah French toast. And I spent years trying to find a comparable deep-fried challah French toast, and I was never able to. Until finally, my brother Dan and I, Dan is similarly haunted by the memory of Peter Pan French toast.
This obviously is a family obsession.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. We decided that we were going to make it for ourselves. And finally, after a great deal of experimentation, we created it. This is deep-fried challah French toast. The crust comes out crisp, chestnut brown, faintly nutty and sweet.
Oh.
The inside is a creamy, moist yellow flavored with cinnamon and vanilla. This is French toast with the power to make the years fall away, Lynn. I'm telling you, one bite of this French toast a la Peter Pan, and just for a moment at least, you need never have to grow up.
Matthew, if you don't share this recipe with our listeners, I guarantee you, you will never do radio again. This sounds so good.
Deep it's yours, Lynn.
All right. Okay, we're going to put it up on the website. Matthew, thank you.
It's my pleasure.
Matthew Goodman writes for the national Jewish publication, The Forward. You can get Matthew's recipe for challah French toast a la Peter Pan two ways. Either send a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101, or go to our website at splendidtable.org. Coming up, physicist Sidney Perkowitz introduces us to the wonders of foam from the cappuccino cup right out to the cosmos. We go to a new kind of rave. It's all about wine. And we're opening the lines for your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. A while ago, I had a restaurant meal made up entirely of foam dishes, from foamed anchovies to foamed watermelon. This is a new trend. But foam is more than trendy. It goes a lot deeper than the meringue on your pie. For instance, according to our guest, Sidney Perkowitz, foam is about things you really wouldn't expect, like bread, protons and quarks, and the universe. Our guest is a physicist, a highly regarded expert on the properties of matter, and a man fascinated by foam. He is Sidney Perkowitz, the Charles Howard Candler Professor of Physics at Emory University. His newest book is Universal Foam, From Cappuccino to the Cosmos. Professor Sidney Perkowitz, welcome.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
Now, you're a physicist, and I understand that you're an expert on the optical properties of matter, right?
Correct. That's correct.
So what's a nice physicist like you doing staring into a cup of cappuccino and writing about foam?
Well, you're right. It's not what physicists are usually pictured as doing, but, you know, we kind of have a warrant to look at anything that interests us in the physical world, and foam sure is interesting. So that's my excuse.
All right. So what's so compelling about foam?
I'd say from the scientific side, it's that commonplace as it is and ordinary as it seems, it really has unanswered questions lingering in it. And from the human side, it's simply that it's fun. It seems to add a lot of pleasure to life in different ways.
How does a physicist define foam?
The definition really is pretty simple. If I give you a pint of liquid or maybe a chunk of matter, and in that liquid or that matter, I mix in some bubbles of gas, I've given you a foam.
Okay, so that can be a plastic like styrofoam, the cup.
Absolutely.
Right.
That's a solid foam.
Right, and that never dies from what I understand. I mean, styrofoam will be here millions of years from now or tens of thousands of years, right?
It turned out to be stronger than steel. If you put it in a landfill, it never goes away. That's right.
And then there's the foam on my cappuccino that disappears.
And, of course, that's the opposite extreme of foam. That's a liquid foam, a very tenuous thing, and yet that's part of its attraction, I think, that it's so fragile.
Huh. Well, what's happening? I mean, from your point of view, when I look at my cup of espresso, my black coffee with that, what the Italians call the crema on top, that lovely sort of coffee-colored foam on top, what am I actually looking at from a scientist's point of view?
I can tell you the geometry of what you're looking at, but actually explaining how the crema forms has not yet been fully understood. Isn't that amazing? But what you're looking at is bubbles of air mixed with the water that was in the coffee with some additional compounds that make the bubble sturdy enough to last for a while. In other words, a classical foam.
Ah, okay. Now, what about some other edible foams?
You know, when I started to think about it, Lynn, I was really amazed and enthralled to find how many examples there are. Beer is obvious. Everyone loves the head on a beer. Bread is a little less obvious, but it's fair to think of that as a solid foam. You start with something semi-liquid. When you make bread dough, you bake it, and you end up with a solid foam. Other forms are soufflés and meringues, and we can even think of some more than that, too.
All right, so now going back to bread for a minute, I don't think most of us ever think of bread as foam. What's actually happening there?
It was a revelation to me, too. Well, you're mixing together flour and the other ingredients with water to make something semi-liquid. Then you put in something to raise the bread, to leaven the bread, typically yeast, although there are other ways to do that. As the yeast interacts with the other compounds, it releases gas, carbon dioxide. That gas makes bubbles. And then as the bread solidifies in the oven, those bubbles get frozen into place. So, again, you have a classical foam. Material full of gas bubbles, that's a foam.
Well, what makes one foam stronger than another? For instance, if I let my egg whites just sit there, they're eventually going to go flat. But there's other foams that just sort of sit there. What is the difference?
It comes down to whatever the additional compound is in your mixture that is making the bubble walls sturdy. So some bubble walls, for instance, those made with what you find in egg white, are especially sturdy. Meringue can do very well if you take good care of it. And others are not so sturdy. Soap sud bubble walls are not very strong. Soap suds don't last very long at all. It's the strength or the robustness of the wall that makes the gas bubble.
So how much time have you actually spent studying these things?
Well, I've been thinking about foam for 3 years or more, and in my case, it really did start from drinking cappuccino. That expanded in a scientific direction. I thought about the science of foam, but then I came back and saw how much foam there was in food, and that excited my interest in a whole different direction.
Huh. Now, your name of your book is Foam from the Cappuccino to the Cosmos. Okay.
Yes.
I think I've got some sense about foam and food, but now you've got to make the leap for me. What about the cosmos?
Oh, I'd love to do that because that's one of the most fascinating manifestations of foam. And actually, if I say cosmos, I mean every level you can think of, from smaller than an electron to the size of many, many galaxies. And let's start at the big end. At the big end, the cosmic sense of foam is this. If you look at how all the galaxies in the universe are arranged, they're arranged as if they made up the surfaces of enormous, enormous soap bubbles, trillions and trillions and trillions of miles across, bubbles sitting cheek by jowl. It really would be fair to say that on the big scale, the universe looks like the head on a beer or the head on a cappuccino.
That's amazing. That's what the universe looks like.
Well, I don't want to offend anyone. We all have our opinions of the universe, but let's say one good geometrical image is the head on a beer. That's absolutely correct.
Okay, now take me to the other end of the spectrum.
Way down at the smallest scale you can think of, think a proton or an electron or a quark or something even smaller than that. If we had powerful enough microscopes, you would see that down at that level, space-time, the stuff that it surrounds us, the three dimensions of length, width, and thickness, and the flow of time, behave as if they're a foam. They change rapidly and radically and randomly, as if you had bubbles of space and time collapsing, distorting, going away, being created. It's a very fascinating image.
So you know what comes to mind as you say that? I'm thinking of standing at the seashore and seeing when waves come crashing in on the sand and they wash up and they leave behind these arcs of foam on the sand.
Lynn, it's a lovely image to illuminate what the universe looks like way down at the smallest scale. I'm talking about space and time forming and changing and bubbling without ever stopping. There's always a dynamic action going on. And your image of the ocean foam, the sea foam, is the same. It never stops changing, whether it's on the top of the wave or just collapsing as it lies on the beach. And by the way, let me add that sea foam is more than just a metaphor for the things I'm talking about. It itself has a function in our world. The temperature of the world and the climate depend on how much sunlight the world absorbs. And because ocean foam is white and it reflects more sunlight than ordinary seawater, it actually affects the climate and the meteorology of the whole world. That's been figured out only quite recently. It was quite a revelation to the scientific community.
So something that you think of as just being sort of a byproduct, you know, a wave goes plunk actually has a reason for being. It's part of the order of things in our world.
It's part of the order of things in our world. We're learning that there are really subtle connections between the ocean, the atmosphere, the land, and life itself. And foam, it seems, plays a role in that as a chapter in that story.
Sydney, thank you so much.
Lynn, it's been my complete pleasure to talk to you.
I'm looking through, and it all would be so crystal clear if it wasn't for the foam. But the foam keeps getting bigger.
Physicist Sydney Perkowitz is author of Universal Foam, From Cappuccino to the Cosmos. The Wine Rave is a new take on the rave theme. It's organized by a group that calls themselves the Wine Brats. Their goal is to get rid of all the stuffy, intimidating baggage that wine carries. Well, John Kalish takes us to a wine rave to find out firsthand.
The L.A. Wine Rave was held at the brand new Knitting Factory nightclub in Hollywood. The Wine Brats is said to be composed mostly of 20-somethings. To the relief of this aging baby boomer, there seemed to be a fair number of 30 and 40-somethings in attendance. This was not an ecstasy-popping jeans and sneakers crowd, but one in which women wore evening gowns and some of the men came in business suits. This young couple first heard of Wine Brats on the Splendid Table.
My name is Jorge Ramirez. I'm from Los Angeles, California. And I'm here with my beautiful fiancée, Maria Mendoza.
I know when I walk into any wine store, I'm just completely overwhelmed at what's out there and all the different titles and names. And I just kind of try to grab one and run because I don't want to act like I don't know what I'm talking about. So it's a great chance to come and sample some different wines.
I learned about, you know, different ventures that are out on the market that I hadn't really heard of. Some good wines that I may try if they're in the, you know, $15 a bottle range.
Ramirez raved about a Merlot produced by BV in the Napa Valley. In addition to the California-based wineries, there were wine industry representatives from Washington State and Australia here at Wine Rave LA.
My name is Debbie, and I'm with Chorus Brands, and we're located up in Washington State. We have a Chardonnay and a Shiraz, and then we also have a Fumé Blanc and a Cab Merlot blend. I've actually had a few people ask some good questions that have come from the component tasting and said, okay, well, I don't want something bitter. I want something maybe a little sweeter or a little softer, more acidic. It's nice that they're getting educated because they really want to learn.
Oak technically isn't one of your five taste buds.
A 25-year-old guy in a white lab coat is doing a lecture and Q&A session in front of a long table with wine bottles and a variety of flavor-enhancing substances. He's got a small throng of very attentive young adults watching and listening closely.
My name is Brendan Eliason. I'm the wine guru, also known as the National Director of Education for the Wine Brats. I went to Cal Poly and studied viticulture. I'm a winemaker up in Sonoma County. One of the big problems with the wine industry right now is people have this incorrect assumption that they have to know about wine in order to drink wine, and they're very much intimidated to drink it. I mean, it's grape juice. The good wine is wine you like. Bad wine is wine you don't like. Eat the food you like with the wine you like. If you want to drink your wine out of a coffee mug, drink it out of a coffee mug. You don't have to obey these rules in order to drink wine.
A number of vino lovers traveled from Northern California down here to the Southland for Wine Rave LA. Chris Cisneros is with the San Francisco chapter of Wine Brats.
I grew up in Sonoma County, and my first experience with wine was drinking in a friend's dad's cellar. And I got sick to my stomach and swore I would never drink it again. And at age 25, I kind of got turned on to it again, going to small tastings, only drinking dessert wines, really. Slowly going to red wines, Zinfandels, Merlots, kind of becoming more in tune with the palate. A lot of people in their 20s drink beer, drink cocktails. I think it's just as good as opening up a can of beer when you get home after work and propping up your feet. Why not have a glass of Merlot?
What's this greasy stuff on Barbie's legs?
That would be olive oil.
A guy in his 40s named Bob Bloomer has just cooked shrimp on the Barbie. And you guessed it, he's got America's favorite doll straddling a bowl of dipping sauce. Bloomer, who's wearing a Krispy Kreme Donuts t-shirt, is known as the Surreal Gourmet. He writes for the Wine Brats magazine, Wine X, and has a piece in the current issue about poaching salmon in a dishwasher.
I was traveling around the country in a Toastermobile. I bought an Airstream trailer direct from the Airstream factory, and I had a $50,000 stainless steel professional kitchen built inside. And then to complete the look, I had two giant 8-foot slices of toast built on top. And I took this around the country to 30 cities.
Bloomer's approach to cooking is in sync with the low-key, don't be intimidated mindset of this event. But the Surreal Gourmet, it turns out, is a real wine connoisseur who served as a judge in some big wine competitions.
I just couldn't understand why people would throw hundreds of dollars at bottles of wine, and slowly but surely I've been sucked in. And in fact, I'm going to France to pick grapes at a very legendary winery called Romani Conte. I'm going to be a migrant farm worker for 2 weeks.
If the Surreal Gourmet shows up at that French winery in his Toastermobile, let's hope he has the good sense to replace the toast sticking out of the top with baguettes. I'm John Kalish in Los Angeles.
This piece was produced for us by John Kalish, the KCRW Gracie Films Radio Arts Fellow.
Hello? Hey, what's going on? How come I never see you around no more? Where you been? Yeah, well, you should call me. When? Well, I get all my messages. I never got any from you.
The lines are officially open for your calls. You can phone us at 800-537-5252 and we will talk. Anything goes. Let's get right to the phones. We've got Don on the line. So, Don, what do you want to talk about?
Well, hello, Lynn. I'm interested in knowing if when you use whipping cream or heavy cream to smooth out sauces.
Yeah.
I only use a very small amount, about a tablespoon or so to smooth them out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to know if you bought a cup of whipping cream, if you could take it and then put it in an ice cream tray or an ice tray, could you freeze it in small amounts and then thaw them out later so you can only get a tablespoon at a time?
That's an awfully good idea. I've never tried it. I know when you freeze cream, it tends to separate when it's defrosted.
Right, right.
But I'm just wondering, you know, Don, I've never tried this, but I would imagine if you whipped it and beat it, you would be able to bring it back together.
This is the beat it after you thaw it out.
After you thaw it out, yeah. It's so hard to beat ice cubes, Don.
Right, I understand.
You know,
that, yes.
It's tough. But it's a good idea because I know what you mean. You use just a little bit. Are you talking about savory sauces, like
That's
pan
right.
sauces, right?
That's right. I'd deglaze a pan and I'd like to add just a tablespoon of cream just to kind of smooth it out rather than make a big cream sauce.
Right, right. So sometimes you're cooking a chicken breast or a piece of fish and you want to take those crumbles
right.
from the bottom of the pan and make a sauce, so you add some liquid and then that cream. I would say, look, why don't you just try it?
Okay.
I mean, I haven't done it, but now you're making me want to go home, buy some cream and put it in. because one of the things you can do, I mean, like, for instance, you can't freeze whipped cream. It's a disaster. But you have that cream left. It always sits in the fridge. It gets yucky. Why not try it? I would just, when you defrost that one cube, because it's great, there's one or two tablespoons per ice cube.
That's right.
Perfect, that thing. I just throw it in the sauce and defrost it there, and I'd use a whisk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, doing it right in the pan, I'd use a whisk and just whisk like crazy and see what you get.
Okay.
Hey.
Well, I'll try it, and I'll let you know how the results turned out.
Hey, thanks for a good question.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. That brings us to our trivia question for the week. This is the part of the show where we try to challenge your knowledge of arcane, fascinating, or just plain useless bits of food lore. This week's question is about an edible foam. It's white, it's sweet, and it can be found in 1/3 of America's homes. What is it? Well, we'll have that answer in a moment and take more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. It's open lines for your calls this hour at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. The question was about a particular edible foam. It's white, it's sweet, and it can be found in one-third of America's homes. So what is it? Well, it's Cool Whip. And it goes back to those glorious pre-cholesterol days of the late 1960s when there was no guilt about whipped cream. It's just that whipped cream was too troublesome to make. I mean, you had to dirty dishes, the cream didn't stay whipped all that long, and it could go bad. So the General Foods people jumped in to fill the void. They eliminated the need for the bowl, the beater, heck, they even eliminated the cream. You could have white, fluffy, creamy topping straight from the freezer anytime. Just peel off the lid and scoop it up. Back in the 60s, Cool Whip was new, modern. As my favorite sources of pop culture, Jane and Michael Stern, put it, whipped cream has only one boring ingredient, cream. Cool Whip is a chemist's delight, filled with things like sorbitan monostearate, polysorbate 60, and xanthan gum. It keeps for months. Now there's even real cream Cool Whip. It's called Extra Creamy. How much cream is in there, I'm not sure, because it's way down on the list of ingredients. But hey, it's there. Then there's the matter of how Cool Whip tastes. I think we'd better get back to the phones now. You can call us at 800-537-5252. Let's see who's up. We've got Joe on the line. So, Joe, what's on your mind?
Well, I have the wonderful, great fortune of living right next door to the downtown St. Paul Farmers Market. And I just moved here from the West Coast, and I was totally unprepared at how ethnically diverse the St. Paul area is.
Boy, and yeah, is it? And people just don't believe it.
I expected, you know, everything to just be, you know, Minnesota and, you know, but it's amazing the cultural diversity here, which is good, but the bad news is there's so much stuff out there I have no clue what to do with. And this week I brought home a bag of bitter melons. And I don't even know if they're a fruit or a vegetable even. And they're about the size and shape of a cucumber.
Right.
But they're a paler green.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really ugly. They're really bumpety looking.
Well, here's the deal with them, okay? Because I gather what you want to know is, okay, now that I've got them, what do I do
exactly
with them?
Exactly. I've also got some little baby round eggplants. I'm not sure about the size of a golf ball. I'm not sure what to do with either.
Are they green?
Yeah. Like beautiful.
Now, I have to tell you, a bag of bitter melon is going to last you probably a long time. Bitter melon is not the easiest vegetable to love. It's used in Asian cooking. I know it in the Chinese kitchen, but I have no doubt it's used in other parts of Asia. Mm-hmm. And as you said, it looks like a cucumber that's had a hard time in life. It's very bumpy and serrated. And the fact is, it's bitter. But The way it's handled in China is that it's peeled and it's seeded. Okay, and it is a vegetable, by the way. It's not a fruit.
Okay.
and then it's steamed or simmered in water for about 5 minutes.
Okay.
So that gets rid of some of the real bitterness. But it tends to be very good with strong flavors, like chilies, like black beans. You know those salted black beans that you see in China? They come in plastic bags in Chinese groceries, and you use them to make garlic black bean sauce for things like spare ribs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you find that garlic black bean sauce recipe, and you just use chunks of pork instead of the spare ribs, which have bones in them, and you just follow that recipe, you've steamed or you've boiled your bitter melon, and what you do is You've removed all the seeds, and then you use it like a boat on the plate, and you have it at room temperature, and you pile that spicy, salty, wonderfully garlicky, braised pork on it, and it's out of this world because the contrast of the rich, full-flavored pork with lots of garlic and the tart melon. Dynamite.
I can't wait to try it.
And as far as the eggplants go, they kind of have a bitter overtone too. But one way that they're used, and this is a great condiment to have on the table, is you cut them into small pieces and you marinate them with rice vinegar.
Okay, I got that.
Right. Chili.
Okay.
A little sugar to taste. And a little fish sauce. You know, Thai or Vietnamese fish sauce. Okay, it's like a dressing. And you can keep it for a couple of weeks in the fridge. And you use it as a condiment with rice and grilled fish.
Ooh.
And the whole tang of it really is delicious. The other thing is they're cooked into curries, Thai curries.
Mm-hmm.
So that's great stuff to try and see
Can't wait. Well, thank you so much. Thanks for your help. I really appreciate it.
You take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Goodbye, Joe. We've got...
Hey.
What?
Hold on.
Looks like we don't have a caller. We have someone knocking at the door of the studio.
All right, let's put this in here.
Wait a minute.
Okay. Where can I plug this in?
Let me explain something. This is Yoon Kerr, who you've heard on the show talking about haggis. Yoon is an editor at Minnesota Public Radio's news department, has just walked into the studio, and he's carrying a toaster and a shopping bag.
And I must admit, a head of steam. I'm pretty upset, Lynn.
What did I do?
You don't remember? The slander?
Nobody ever comes into my studio like this, you know, I have to tell you.
Just on this very program a couple of weeks ago, you had the temerity to upset Marmite lovers all around the world. Well, at least all the ones that listen to your show.
Okay, Yoon, I think I know what you're referring to. We had a call a couple of weeks ago from someone who wanted to know what Marmite sandwiches
are. Sounded like a very wise man in search of knowledge. And you sent him away. You told him that it was nasty stuff. And it's not.
Did I use that word?
Well, maybe not, but... this is it.
I don't think
taste test time.
He's got a jar.
We have the jar of Marmite
here. I didn't know
they
made Marmite in a jar that big.
This is the medium size. There's actually a 7-pound one, but this thing says here holds, I think it's 157 portions of Marmite.
Where do you get this, you?
Oh, we Marmite lovers have our secret sources. Actually, I bought it in a supermarket in Glasgow, but.
All right, but now wait a minute.
Okay.
I think you better tell everybody what the stuff is.
Well, we have to prepare, actually. Let me get the bread out and get the toast going.
What exactly is it that you're doing here?
Well, people say all sorts of nasty, scurrilous things about Marmite. And many of them are probably true. What this is a marvelous byproduct of the brewing industry.
Well, anything that's a byproduct of brewing can't be all bad.
You're getting more interested already. Basically, I mean, I may have the actual technical parts a little wrong. This is the scrapings left over from the inside of the vase. Well, maybe that's not true. But it's definitely a yeast extract. And sometime, actually about 100 years ago, somebody thought, we should use this stuff for something. Because, you know, people didn't want to be wasteful. So let's see what we can do with it. Now as you can see, as we open up the jar here, it actually doesn't look very appetizing. I will give you that. It looks a little like very highly used axle grease. And
see, now, I was going to be kind.
You were,
and just
okay.
say it was the color of dark sable.
No, axle grease. No. Axle grease. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to make a British classic here, which is a, this is Marmite on toast. This isn't the Marmite sandwich, which was talked about, but we'll go back to the basic stuff here.
Okay.
We should quickly point out that Marmite, while looking unpleasant, is very good for you. It has all these things in it, like niacin, thiamine, that one I can never pronounce, riboflavin,
the one that's in there,
yeah, what that
yes.
thing, folic acid, and vitamin B12.
Can I have a sniff?
Sure.
Oh, you really? I have.
Yep.
Oh, there goes the toaster.
The toaster's ready.
I have to tell everybody. You know what it smells like? It really smells like a bouillon cube.
It's got a strong smell, and it's really important to spread it thinly. It's really important to have this done thinly, and I have to admit, you have to have a lot of butter. Oh, did I say a lot of butter? Can be very. Okay,
he's
let's...
brought a stick of butter.
Yes, we have butter here.
He's brought plates.
Now, yeah. Now, out comes the Marmite. This marvelous stuff. Now, remember, thin, thin, thin.
He's taking these little smears at
yeah,
the tip of from the tip of the knife.
Not spreading it quite as well, but anyway, how about that? Okay, let's cut it in half here.
All right.
Now, should we take the leap together here?
You know what? The butter covers up the smell of the Marmite.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Right.
Now we're going to taste this.
Okay. Ah, she ate it. Oh, no. There's a pained expression on your face.
I think that's awful. But there's something else. There's something else, though. Ever the polite, ever the diplomatic.
You are polite.
I could see how after a while it could get to you. It's nutritious, right? It's good for you?
Yeah.
It's good
oh,
for
yeah.
you. I'm glad. Now I'm going to eat all around the brown stuff because the bread is great and the butter's wonderful.
Well, while you're eating, I should point out that I have a number of friends who are vegetarians for political reasons, and they occasionally have non-politically correct cravings.
Uh-huh.
And that's where Marmite comes in. This is used as an addition to vegetarian stews to give a slightly savory
now,
taste.
This is where I remember Marmite mm-hmm. being used. And it's great because when you have a weak stew or the soup is
yeah.
kind of weak-kneed, you stir some of this mm-hmm. in. It's like a real concentrate.
Yeah.
It's like a very classy bouillon
yeah.
cube. And you know what? One more bite and I may get to like this stuff.
Well, you know, can I tell you a secret? I have lots of this stuff in the house. But my secret fear is that my children are going to grow to like this, and then I'll have to share.
I don't think that's going to be a problem.
Oh, okay. I'll be on my way then.
Well, Ian, thanks.
Oh, you're welcome. Cheerio.
Okay, let's get back to the calls now. We have Anna on the line. So, Anna, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Oh, I'm so happy I found your show.
Oh, have we been lost?
Well, I just heard it for the first time last week, and I'm happy I found it.
Oh, where are you?
I'm calling from Madison, Wisconsin.
Oh, you're in Wisconsin, right. Yes. Our neighbor, right.
Yes.
So,
anyway,
did you have a profound question to ask, Anna?
Well, I don't know how profound it is. Actually, I'm worried that it's so not profound that it may be too obtuse. It's, what are capers?
That's not an obtuse question. I think a lot of people don't know what they are, and I didn't know what they were until I decided to find out. Do you know what they are? They're the bud of a flower.
Oh.
And they're cured. They're pickled. And one way you do it is you just pick the buds and you put them in lots and lots of sea salt and you pack them away and they smell like old socks for a month and then they're cured and then they smell great. And those are salted capers. And you find that all over the Mediterranean. It's a very ancient way of preserving them. And another way is that they're picked and they're put in like vinegar. And that's what we often see in the supermarket are the ones that are packed in vinegar. And the flower that would come from that bud is this beautiful, beautiful thing. It almost looks like an orchid. It has the petals of an orchid and then it has like a starburst of purple in the center of it. And it grows wild. I mean, it grows like a weed all over much of the Mediterranean. So that's what a caper is. And it's a, well, have you tasted them?
No, well, probably. It's probably been in things that I just didn't know about. But I see it, well, see, I found a recipe on the internet, and it's for salmon, a salmon broccoli loaf, and I always see them called for in a fish recipe.
Yeah, they're very good with fish. And one of the things is that they're usually very good with anything that has butter in it. They're wonderful with salmon. They have the salted ones you usually drop in water. A lot of people do this for about 5 or 10 minutes. You soak them and then you use them. And they have this flowery green sweet taste to them that's really nice. The vinegar ones tend to be, of course, tartar. But yeah, you use them with any kind of fish, especially fattier fish. You know, so like salmon or mullet or bluefish.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, like in your loaf. And you can also, they're wonderful with light meats. So they're great with pork and they're great with anything that has fat, anything that's pale in color.
Okay, well, one more thing. This recipe says use the small capers. Are they bottled or like packaged?
Well, yeah, there used to be this whole deal that the tinier the caper, the better it was. And those were usually the ones packed in vinegar. But then we discovered the Mediterranean craze about a decade ago. And that's when people discovered that in the Mediterranean, where people live with capers all the time, they like big, fat ones that have been cured in salt or vinegar. So you know what? Whatever you can get, use. Both of them are going to work really well.
I guess since I don't know what they are, I couldn't tell if it was a big one or a small one anyway.
That's right. Exactly. Everything in life is relative. If it's under a half inch, I would figure it's a fairly large caper. If it's under an eighth of an inch, it's a small caper.
Okay, well, I'll try them. I won't omit them this time when I see them. I'll just try them.
They're great. They're great fun, and they keep forever, you know, so you can have them hanging around.
Oh, well, thanks a lot, Lynn.
Hey, thanks for calling.
Bye.
Goodbye. I had a great meal recently in San Diego. The restaurant is called Taka, T-A-K-A, and I guess the best way to describe the food is Japanese nouvelle. There's great service. The prices aren't sky high. It's a real sleek, modern place, not very large. You're going to need a reservation. Now, you could sit at the sushi bar, but at a nearby table, you can get the sushi, and you can have enough room on the table to sample stuff from the main menu. Don't miss two of the soups, okay? One is miso, and it's based on grains, and it smells like a pine forest. It's luscious. The other one is made from dashi, which is made from dried fish and seaweed, but don't be put off. It's so delicate. Lovely bits of vegetables and tofu floating in that. The other thing is there's a salad on the sushi menu that is killer. Clam with seaweed. Four kinds of seaweed. They're pure and briny, cool, crunchy, and each one tastes different. All you need is lemon juice on that. Also on the menu is the salmon skin roll. Now, this is outstanding. It's thin strips of salmon skin that have been grilled until they're crusty and brown. Now, they're mixed with, or they're lined up with, bits of cooked salmon meat, and that's put into that vinegary sweet sushi rice, and it's all rolled up in black seaweed. Just about everything we tried in the appetizer line was wonderful, and they're small dishes, so you can share them between two or three people. The only thing is you may want to skip the entrees. They're pretty predictable, nowhere near as interesting as the rest of the menu. So if you get to San Diego, try Taka. T-A-K-A. It's downtown, near the hotels, and we're going to post it up on our website at splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for today. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Have a great week, and remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. Now, until next week, let me leave you with some thoughts on health from Mark Twain. The only way to keep our health is to eat what we don't want, drink what we don't like, and do what we would rather not do. The Splendid Table is brought to you by the kitchenware area at Target, offering the latest assortment of tea kettles with flip-up whistles, 1810 stainless steel exteriors, and heat-resistant handles. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Jennifer Russell and Sally Swift. Our associate producer is Jennifer Lubke. The theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper.
RRI, Public Radio International.